we're getting into the book of Esther this evening. The book of Esther is the fifth of the five books of the Megillah, or the Festival Scrolls. And the setting of the book of Esther is during the period of the captivity of the Jews. This was during the Persian period. You remember, of course, the story that Nebuchadnezzar conquered Judah and destroyed Jerusalem about 586 B.C. and took people into captivity. Well, of course, after his conquest, almost 50 years after his final destruction of Jerusalem, the Babylonian Empire was overthrown by the Medes and the Persians. That's described in the book of Daniel, chapter 5. And the Persian period continued on down for about the next 200 years. Cyrus the Great was the king of Persia that conquered Babylon, and he is the one who issued a decree allowing the Jews to return. That occurred under Zerubbabel. Well, that period between when Zerubbabel led the first of the Jews back out of Babylon to back to Jerusalem to rebuild, and the time that's later picked up in the book of Ezra when Ezra came back, during those several decades in between is when the book of Esther is set. And you know, while some Jews returned to Babylon, or returned from Babylon to Jerusalem, many of the Jews stayed in the land of their captivity, and the book of Esther picks up the story of those there in who remained in the Persian Empire. Now, the book of Esther is unique because it doesn't have the name of God. You know, a lot of commentaries will bring this out. The book of Esther is unique because God's name is not directly mentioned anywhere in the book of Esther. Now, that is partially true. You won't find a direct mention of it, but there's a very interesting occurrence. And that is the fact that there are five places in the book of Esther, if you are looking in Hebrew, where the name of God is spelled out, YHVH, is spelled out in an acrostic, in a four-word statement. Either the initial words or the initial letters of each of the four words is YHVH, or the end letter of each of the words is YHVH. That occurs five times in the book of Esther, and it's sort of interesting. Some of the Jews, of course, noted that, and little plays on things and acrostics are popular in Hebrew, and we noticed when we went through the book of Lamentations that there was a play on that out of the five chapters of Lamentations, four of them had 22 verses corresponding to the letters of the alphabet, and one of them had 66 verses, three times 22. And you find that various places. Psalm 119 is perhaps the most familiar. But it's sort of interesting, you know, that's a little bit intriguing. And what you find is you go through the book of Esther, and we're going to notice it this evening, is that while God's name is not directly mentioned, the hidden hand of God is always evident. And it's almost, I think there are a couple of things that would certainly tie in terms of God's name not being directly mentioned in Esther. One that comes to mind is, of course, Esther is the book that authorizes Purim. And Purim is a holiday that the Jews celebrate as a time of their deliverance from the events described in the book of Esther. Now, Purim is not a holy day. God did not command the observance of Purim. It's a holiday. And that is clearly differentiated in the book of Esther, that the decree came from Mordecai and Esther. It was not. There's nothing wrong with that any more than there is with us commemorating a day of Thanksgiving that's been proclaimed by the President and by Congress, a national day of Thanksgiving. Well, that's good. We ought to be thankful. The Jews certainly were delivered, and it was appropriate to celebrate that. But I think one of the things we will find, I read a definition one time of coincidence, and the definition said that coincidence is when God chooses to remain anonymous. And we're going to notice that there's a lot of coincidences in the book of Esther of things that just so happened that. Well, what we look at is that there are times when God's intervention is very much out front. You go through the book of Exodus, for instance, and you read story after story of God's miraculous intervention. His name is emblazoned from start to finish. You go through the book of Esther and you find something different. Now, you again find God's intervention. There's no way you can study the book of Esther and come away without perceiving the hand of God. And yet, in this case, the Red Sea wasn't parted and all of the plagues of Egypt didn't come down and all of these great dramatic signs. And yet, God's intervention and God's hand was very evident. God did not choose to reveal himself in a dramatic, out front, miraculous way, but he worked through the circumstances to provide for and to deliver his people. And one of the things I think that comes out with the book of Esther as we look at the story is the fact that, you know, sometimes things happen that seemingly don't make sense. You know, as you very quickly get into the book of Esther, you find that Esther's life took a dramatic turn that had to be very, very different than anything she had ever envisioned growing up, anything that her cousin Mordecai had ever envisioned. He was evidently an older cousin, more like an uncle, and had raised her. You know, here was an observant Jewish family. She grew up with certain goals and aspirations, certain dreams, as would be normal. And yet her life took a turn that no one could have foreseen. She certainly never foresaw that. Her uncle never foresaw that, or Mordecai, rather, never foresaw that. But, you know, God worked through circumstances. And I think that's part of the lesson of faith, that God can work through circumstances to accomplish things in ways that you and I would never imagine. Now, the king that is introduced in the book of Esther, the king of Persia, called in Hebrew Ahasuerus, better known, and I'll use the name, the Greek name that by which he's well known, because it's easier to pronounce. Xerxes is the name he's known by history. In history, one of the things, just sort of as an aside, that you know, when you have different languages, not only different languages, but written in different alphabets, you find that there's often significant change in the spelling of letters and spelling of words and the use of letters. And that's because there's not an exact correlation from one alphabet to another. And for instance, in just to give you one example, in Hebrew there's the letter for SH. It's one letter, the shin in Hebrew. In Greek, there's no corresponding SH. And so anytime you find a name in the Old Testament that had an SH in it, and in the New Testament in Greek, it's just an S, because they didn't have they didn't make the sound as far as the way they spelled out words. So most of our history, much of our ancient history, has come down through the Greeks, the Greek historians. And so commonly the names we use for ancient kings is really not so much the name they use for themselves as the way the Greek historians spelled it. And so that, you know, if you're interested in the subject, there are certain reference books that show you how the letters corresponded and how they actually got some of these tangled up pronunciations that you and I would never have come up with. But anyway, we pick up the story here with Xerxes, who reigned over the Persian Empire, which stretched from India to Ethiopia. So it was a vast empire. And he was having a party, and actually the story of it, if you said it historically, is right before he was getting ready for an invasion of Greece. And he had this great party. Now, one of the things about the Persians that comes out is it mentions here in, let's see, in verse 5, talks about the king made a feast to all the people that were present in Shushan the palace. And it uses this term feast several places in the book of Esther. This is not the word that is used for feast when referring to God's festivals. The particular word that's translated feast more literally means a drinking. And when you read the story, you find out that's really the main thing. I mean, they may have had some food, but it was one big long happy hour. And that explains a lot of what was going on. The Persians were notorious for their, you know, for their use of alcohol. And so we find that he was having this big festivity, and they were really drinking it up. And it describes just one other sort of interesting little sidelight. Of course, the skeptics and many of the so-called scholars disputed the historical character of the Book of Esther. But it's interesting because when you find described here the king's palace, and it talks about the white, green, and blue hangings, and it talks about the pavement of red and blue and white and black marble, and describes all this. Well, you know, it's interesting, in the last few decades, as archaeologists uncovered some of the ruins of Persian palaces, of the Persian palace there in Shushan, what should they find? But this is an exact description of what the thing looked, right on down to the floor tile. So obviously written by somebody who had been there and who knew that it was, the pavement was red and blue and white and black marble. And just sort of interesting. Well, he was giving them drink in vessels of gold and royal wine in abundance according to the state of the king. I guess that means he was drinking royal wine in abundance, and he wanted everybody else to be just as abundant. And the drinking, this verse 8 is a little awkwardly translated in English. The sense of it is that they weren't just drinking toasts when the king called out, you know, or somebody called out a toast and they drink to that. None did compel that they should do according to every man's pleasure. In other words, it was just all you could drink, put out on the table, and they just drank, you know, whatever they wanted. They weren't waiting for a toast or some signal. So it was sort of explains the state of things, you see. Then the Vashti, the queen, was making a feast. A drinking for the women in the royal house. And on the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, so he'd been having a drinking for the last week, and he was decided at this point that he wanted his seven chamberlains that to bring Vashti the queen before the king with the crown royal to show the people and the princes her beauty. Well, she wouldn't come. So not only had he been drinking, she had obviously been drinking too. No, I'm not going in there. So the king was very wroth, and his anger burned in him. Boy, did that make him mad. Embarrassed him in front of everybody. Told the queen to come in here and show off, and she wouldn't do it. And the king then talks to the wise men. And it describes, gives a list of these seven princes of Persia, the ones that could come in and actually see the king's face. He says, what are we going to do to the queen according to the law? She didn't do what I told her to. And one of the advisors answered, and he says, you know what? She hasn't just done wrong to the king, but to all the princes and all the people. You know, word of this is going to get out to all the women, and they're going to despise their husbands. When it was reported that the king commanded the queen to be brought in and she wouldn't come, the ladies of Persia and Media are going to say to all the king's princes that have heard of the deed of the queen, thus shall there arise much contempt and wrath. Okay, they talk this over and they really decide this is a serious matter. So they say, if it please the king, there needs to go a royal commandment, be written according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, not to be altered. You know, the Medes and the Persians were noted that the law of the Medes and the Persians was permanent. It couldn't be altered. You couldn't come back and say, no, you know, that was a mistake. We'll reverse that. Because the Medes and the Persians, the king of the Medes and the Persians was viewed as like God on earth. And obviously he didn't make mistakes. So if he said it, then it stayed on the books, which then gave rise to some ingenious figuring as to how you can keep the law on the books and get around it. They had lawyers back then, sort of like they have today. That's what happened in Louisiana. You know, it was enshrined into the Constitution of Louisiana, put in back in the 1890s, banning gambling from the state. It was, in fact, part of the oath of office that every public official took, the governor had to take, was to suppress gambling. And that's still in the Louisiana Constitution. You see, they would have had to have passed a constitutional amendment, which was difficult. We don't have gambling in Louisiana. You might be surprised if you go through Bossier and Shreveport and look at the boats and the casinos and all that. No gambling exists over there. They have gaming. All of that by statute is defined as gaming. So it's still against the law to gamble. You can just game. That's the way Edwin Edwards got around having to do a constitutional amendment. So, some things... You can come up with a law, and then if somebody is bound and determined to get around it, they usually find a way. Anyway, the king sends out a law. And according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, word is to go out that the queen, Vashti, is no longer to come before the king. And he was going to make somebody else his queen. And the decree was made and published, and... that all the wives were to give to their husbands honor, both to great and small. Well, the saying pleased the king and the princes. You know, they were all well lubricated. They thought this was a good idea. So they sent letters to every prophet that every man should bear rule in his own house. And it was published according to the language of every people. Now, this guy was a real winner when it came to that sort of thing. He was really going to instruct people about how to carry out their marriage. Well, we're told in chapter 2, verse 1, after these things, when the wrath of the king was appeased, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what was decreed against her. Now, trouble is about to come. In the meantime, what the Bible skips over, there's a period of a little over a year in between, because they were planning this great invasion of Greece. And the king put together an army of 1 million men, and they marched on Greece. And they never made it across, you know, if you look at a map where Turkey and Greece almost meet right there, called the Hellespont, or the anciently, or the Dardanelles. The king of Persia put together a sort of a pontoon bridge that he was going to march his men across, and a storm came up and wrecked the thing, and he lost a bunch of soldiers, and he never could get them across, and they just had a fiasco, one thing after another. So he came back to Persia. And, he was not in a real good mood. And now, you know, he was sitting around and he was thinking about Vashti. Because he had been talked into this, and this whole scheme had come up back when he was drunk, and they had all been drinking, and his buddies were egging him on. And now he is remembering Vashti, and he's beginning to feel bad. Well, the guys, you know, the antenna goes up. They know what's about to happen. He's not happy, and so he's going to look for somebody to blame. And they figure, you're the one that talked me into signing that, aren't you? Well, they figured they better hurry and come up with another idea. And so they said, King, you know what? You need a new queen. What we ought to do is hold a beauty contest throughout the Persian Empire. We will go and select the prettiest girls from all over the empire. We'll bring them here. And you can bring them in, and you can just take one every night, and you can decide which one you want to make queen. Well, for some reason, you know, that sounded like a pretty good idea to him. He thought that sounded pretty good, and so they had come up with this idea. So the king was going to appoint officers to go out and find these, and this thing pleased the king, and we're told in verse 4. Now, in Shushan the palace, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai. It gives his genealogy. And his family had been taken into captivity by Nebuchadnezzar. And he brought up a cousin whose name was Hadassah. That was her Hebrew name. Esther was the Persian name. And... She was very beautiful, and he brought her up just like his daughter. So he must have been, even though they were cousins, he must have been a number of years older than she was. Well, it came to pass, when the king's commandment and his decrees were heard, when many maidens were gathered together to Shushan, Esther was brought into the king's house, to the custody of the keeper of the women. Now, this gives you an idea. You know, when somebody is brought somewhere and put in custody, it's not like somebody came around and said, hey, would you like to enter this contest? No, I don't think I would. Oh, okay. We'll see you later. No, it was a little more coercive than that, wasn't it? The officers came around, and they said, come on with us. You know, we're going to bring you over here. We're going to put you in custody. We've got... Now, put yourself a little bit... You and I have read the book. We know the story of the book of Esther. You know, Esther didn't know the story of the book of Esther, neither did Mordecai. Imagine how desperate they must have felt when the soldiers showed up and hauled Esther off to the palace complex. How scared she must have been, how upset Mordecai must have been. And Mordecai had evidently had enough opportunity. He told her, he said, don't let them know you're a Jew. You know, no telling what they'll do to you then, because just of the whole situation. You know, things hadn't changed a whole lot over in Persia this day. Anyway, Mordecai had given her that. And every day he walked before the court of the women to know how Esther did and what had become of her. You know, you can just imagine. Esther's praying, Mordecai's praying, their friends are praying. Mordecai is just continually on his mind. Every day he's going down there trying to walk up and down, keep his ear out and see if he can hear any news of Esther. Surely God's going to get her out of there. God's going to get her out of there. Don't you think that that was what he was praying and hoping? Well, time went by. And when every maid's turn came to go into the king, after she'd been 12 months there, and then whatever she asked for, whatever she wanted to wear by way of clothes and jewelry and all that sort of thing was given to her when she went out of the house of the women into the king's house. Well, in the evening she went, and on the morrow she returned to the second house of the women, the one where the concubines lived. And she didn't go back to the king unless he happened to call for her, unless he remembered her name the morning after the night before and said, oh, yeah, I want so-and-so. Why don't you send her back? Well, a lot of these women, they were just over there from now on out. I mean, what a miserable circumstance and situation. Well, Esther's turn came. And she was brought in, and she asked the king's chamberlain what to wear, what to do, and he picked out things for her, and she went in. And the king loved Esther. And he loved Esther above all the women. She obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins. So he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen. So he was really in a good mood at this point, and he made a great drinking unto all his princes and servants. Even Esther's feast, Esther's drinking, that's what he called it. And he made release to the provinces and gave gifts. And so this all continued on, and Mordecai was sitting in the king's gate. He stayed around as close as he could, wanting to find out what was going on. Now, she had not yet told them that she was a Jew. Mordecai had instructed her in that. And so she did what Mordecai told her. Just this is the way she had been brought up. And while Mordecai was there in the king's gate, he overheard two of the king's chamberlain plotting that they were going to kill the king. And when Mordecai heard this assassination plot, he got word to Esther, and Esther got word to the king in Mordecai's name. Well, when inquisition was made of the matter, they found it out. And so they hung these two chamberlains. This, of course, was dutifully inscribed in the book of the Chronicles of the king. Well, a little while later, you know, just coincidentally, the king promoted Haman, the Agagite, and advanced him above all the princes that were with him. Now, if you want the story of Agag, you know, it's interesting, again, the coincidence, because what do you find about Mordecai's ancestry right here at the beginning of the book? What are we told about Mordecai's ancestry? Well, we're told that Mordecai was a Benjamite, we're told in Esther 2, verse 5. He was the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. Now, the genealogy isn't traced way back, but you remember Kish was a common name. It showed up in one particular branch of the family of Benjamin, and that was in Saul's family. Saul's father was Kish, and the name Kish is used several times in that line. Mordecai was a Benjamite. Now, related to Saul, may have very well been a direct descendant or descended from a collateral line. Now, if you remember the story back in 1 Samuel, Saul was commanded by God to destroy the Amalekites. There was a particular Amalekite that escaped, or was not destroyed by Saul. His name was Agag, the king of the Amalekites. And evidently, that exemption included some of Agag's family. So now we pick up the story years later, centuries later, and we find a certain Benjamite, perhaps a direct descendant of Saul, certainly of that family, and we find a fella who is an Agagite, a descendant of Agag. So now we have coming back together threads of a story that you could find back in 1 Samuel. Now, Haman was promoted, and everybody was to bow and reverence Haman. Mordecai didn't bow and didn't do him reverence. Mordecai didn't have any use for the Agagites or the rest of the Amalekites, and he knew what God said about them. And, you know, various commentators speculate different things. Some think that he wore various idolatrous symbols, which he probably did, and what all the reasons for Mordecai refusing to bow to it. I think that it involved more than that, because I'm sure the king of Babylon wore idolatrous symbols, and yet you find Daniel and the others showing respect to his office. So I think it was more directly because he was who he was. And anyway, a little later, somebody called Haman's attention to see whether Mordecai had nerve enough to, you know, keep standing when Haman looked directly at him. They told Haman, yeah, this guy's a Jew. When Haman saw that Mordecai didn't bow and do reverence, Haman was full of wrath. Now, he thought that it was beneath him simply to go and do something to Mordecai. He found out Mordecai was a Jew, and Haman hated Jews. So he said, you know what, I'm going to get rid of Mordecai, but I'm going to get rid of all the Jews. All the Jews throughout the whole kingdom. Now, it was the first month, the month of Nisan, in the 12th year of the king, and they cast Pur, which is the singular form. Purim is the plural form. The I-M ending is in Hebrew is the plural form, like our S. It meant they... Basically, they roll dice, only this time they just roll one, and a lot. Haman was going to choose his lucky day, what he thought was going to be his lucky day. He rolled it from day to day, from month to month, and he wound up in the 12th month, and then they come on down, and we find that they picked the 13th day. Well, as you come on down, Haman then goes into the king. And he said, King, you know there's some troublemakers scattered around, dispersed among all your people, and they're different than everybody else, and they don't really keep your laws. And you know, it's really not to your advantage to keep them around. I'll tell you what, why don't we just make a law that they be destroyed? And I'll pay 10,000 talents of silver to the hand of those that have the charge of the business. Bring it into the king's treasury. The king took his ring from his hand, gave it to Haman, the Jew's enemy. Now, the ring was a signet ring. And one of the things you'll find as you go through the book of Esther, King Xerxes liked his liquor and he liked his harem, but he really didn't like to be bogged down with the day-to-day business of being a king. And every time something came up, he said, yeah, you be in charge of that. Here, you go make a law and sign my name to it. That's what it meant when you give them your ring. See, then they could stamp it with the official seal. So you find that Xerxes had a habit of doing that. And so he told Haman, look, you just keep the money. Go ahead, get rid of them. That's fine with me. You know, what a wonderful fellow to have as king. You know, here, you know, where's the next drink? That was what he was wondering. Yeah, you go take care of the laws. Yeah, make the law, sign my name to it. Look, I think I'll have another drink. Bartender, you know, come on over here. What a wonderful guy to be king. And you know, what would be even better, what a wonderful guy to be married to. The king's scribes were called on the 13th day of the first month. Now, you know when that is? That's the day before Passover. That's the day before Passover. What a wonderful time. You see, there was a decree that told everybody, and it was signed with the king's name, sealed with his ring, letters to be sent out to cause to perish, to destroy, to kill, and to cause to perish all Jews, young and old, little children and women, in one day on the 13th day of the 12th month, the month Adar, and then to take all their spoil for a prey. So this is proclaimed on the third. This is proclaimed the day before Passover there in Shushan, and word is sent out all over the empire. Well, can you imagine? And now you see they're given basically 11 months to get ready for this, but everybody knows. Because it's the killings are to take place on the 12th month. This is the first month. Haman thinks he's come up with his lucky day. He's been casting lots and, you know, shooting dice. And, yeah, well, I got the lucky day. I'm going to fix those Jews. So we'll see that, you know, trying to pick out your lucky day is not necessarily a good idea either by the time we get to the book. So word went out. Notice the last thing in verse 15. Well, notice the last thing in verse 15. The king and Haman sat down to drink, but the city of Shushan was perplexed. You know, I think probably the king did a lot of that. And, Haman knew, hey, you know, king, I got some new stuff. You and I ought to try some. Yeah, that sounds like a good idea. They sat down to drink, and the whole city is there scratching their heads saying, what in the world is this all about? You're going to kill all the Jews? Well, why would they do that? Mordecai perceived all that was done. You know, it didn't take long, so here he gets word about Passover time. And it went out on the day of the 13th, if that's when it was sealed and word went out. Well, you know, when sunset sets at the end of the 13th, it's Passover night. So as the Jews met for Passover, at least in Shushan, it would have taken longer for word to get out in other parts of the empire, but right there in Shushan, when they set out for Passover that evening, they have got a cloud hanging over them. They are faced with death. Before the next Passover comes around, they're all supposed to be dead. Mordecai, when he hears, he puts on sackcloth and ashes, is in mourning, goes out into the city, cried out with a loud and bitter cry, came before the king's gate. Nobody could come in clothed with sackcloth. Well, there was great mourning among the Jews, fasting, weeping, wailing. Many lay in sackcloth and ashes. Esther's maids and her chamberlains came and told her, said, boy, you know, this fellow out there that seems acquainted with you, this Mordecai, you know, he's sitting out there in sackcloth and ashes. Well, she didn't know what had transpired. She sent some clothes out, and he wouldn't take it. And so Esther sent somebody down there to find out what was going on. And he went down and found Mordecai. And Mordecai told him what had happened and what Haman had promised to the king and all the various things to destroy the Jews. Gave him a copy of the writing and told him, show this to the queen and tell her. And charge her to go to the king. Tell her, I said, for her to go to the king and to make supplication and make request. Well, the king told Esther. And Esther sent word back to Mordecai. she said, look, that is not nearly as simple as you think. You think, you know, he's the king, I'm the queen, all I got to do is go in and talk him out of this. What you have to realize is nobody comes into the king unless they're called for. If you come into the king, into the inner court, and you're not called, there's one law. And that's, you're just put to death. You're just executed. There's a fellow standing there with a big sword. He's ready to chop your head off if you come in and haven't been called for. Unless the king happens to notice you and holds out the golden scepter, you know, he can spare you. But if you walk in there uncalled for, you're that's a death sentence. I haven't been called for a month. You know, again, what a how totally different must this have been than anything Esther could have ever imagined as a girl growing up. Well, Mordecai heard what Esther said, and he sent an answer back to her. And he said, listen, don't think that you're going to escape in the king's house more than all the Jews. If you hold your peace at this time, enlargement and deliverance will arise to the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house are going to be destroyed. Who knows whether you are come to the kingdom for such a time as this? You know, the first time, a little glimmer went off in Mordecai's mind. And he said, because now, see, period of time has gone by. We don't know exactly how long, but at least perhaps a couple of years, maybe more. Time has gone by. And all this time, it's been inexplicable to Mordecai. Why would God let this happen? Why would he let my cousin, this beautiful girl, I raised her from a child. She grew up, you know, be maybe 18, 19. Such a future ahead. And then all of a sudden the soldiers show up and she's taken off to the king's palace. Why would God let that happen? You ever have things where you wonder, why would God let that happen? Don't you think Mordecai must have wondered that? And Esther must have wondered that? Now the first spark begins to go off Mordecai's mind. He said, you know, maybe the reason you're there. You see, one of the things we have to understand when we find ourselves in what seems like a problem that you can't extricate yourself from, God already has a solution. God is not up there scratching his head thinking, oh, what am I going to do? I don't have a way to get him out of this. I never thought of that kind of problem. God already has a solution in mind. So Esther sent back word and she said, well, I'll tell you what. You go get all the Jews together in Shushan and fast for me, 3 days and three nights. And fasting, interestingly, is defined here, neither eat nor drink. Don't eat nor drink 3 days, night nor day. I and my maidens are going to do the same thing. And then I'm going to go into the king. Then if I perish, I perish. So Mordecai went and did this. So again, we see here certainly the evidence of faith. Now it came to pass when Esther put on her royal apparel and stood in the inner court. You know, she's been fasting for the last 3 days. What a wonderful thing. You know, she's going to go in to see her husband, so she fasts 3 days and asks all her friends to fast because she's going to go in to see him. Knowing what a, you know, who knows what kind of shape he was going to be in when she showed up. You know, sometimes we read the Bible and we think it must have been really simple for people back in Bible days. I mean, they just had faith. You know, God worked miracles. And they just had faith. And today it's different. You know, it wasn't different. Esther was scared. She said, well, I'm going to put it in God's hands. I'm going to fast, ask everybody else to fast, and then I'm going to go in. And she was prepared at that point to accept God's will. If I perish, I perish. Well, she came in, and the king happened to see her. And he held out the golden scepter, and he was in a good mood. He said, what do you want, Queen Esther? What's your request? I'll give you anything you want, up to half the kingdom. Boy, he was really feeling good. And she said, well, look, you know, if you really want to do something for me, I want to have a special meal, a special banquet for you and Haman. And I'd like for you to come over to my apartment and eat. Well, the king said, cause Haman to make haste, so that he may do as the queen said. And the king and Haman came to the banquet that Esther had prepared. Now notice, the king said unto Esther at the banquet of wine. Esther knew, you know, what the king wanted, and so she made sure that there was plenty of it there for him. He sits there, and he's enjoying his wine, and he says, now, what is your petition? You know, even when he was soused, he was smart enough to know that she didn't just come in risking her life to invite him to dinner. So he knows there's a little more to the story. See, he can figure out a few things. He's not real swift on the uptake, but every now and then he figures out something. He says, what is it you want? I'll give you anything you want, even half the kingdom. And Esther said, you know, my petition, my request, if I've really found favor in your sight, if you are willing to grant my petition, to perform my request, you know, she sort of builds up. Well, what is it? What is it? She says, you know, what I'd like is for you and Haman to come back to dinner again. I'm going to prepare, and we'll do it again tomorrow. And then tomorrow I'll tell you a little more. Haman went forth that day joyful. Oh, he had a glad heart. He was so happy. He saw Mordecai the Jew in the king's gate. Mordecai didn't stand up, didn't move over for him. And Haman was full of wrath. Boy, that just ruined his whole day. He got home, called his friends, told his wife. He told them all the wonderful things he had. Now the king had promoted him, and now he had been invited to a banquet by the king, by the queen, just him and the king. But he says, you know, verse 13, it avails me nothing every time I see that old Mordecai. And so his wife and his friends said, you know what you ought to do? You ought to build a big gallows. Just go ahead and hang him. This huge high gallows. And then go merrily with the king to the banquet. You know, you can just make your day. Just hang on Mordecai and then you can go to the banquet. The thing pleased Haman. He thought that was a wonderful idea. Now here we come to another coincidence, chapter 6. The king just, for some reason, couldn't sleep that night. And he wanted something to put him to sleep, so he commanded that he bring the book of the records of the Chronicles and read it. You know, if that didn't put him to sleep, nothing would. Bring some of that boring stuff in here and read to me. So they just brought it in there, and they just happened to open up, you know. And where did they open up? Well, they read about Mordecai telling about these two chamberlains that had plotted to assassinate the king. And the king says, oh, by the way, what did I ever do for that guy? You know, I must have rewarded him for that. He saved my life. What did I ever do? And they said, well, actually, it doesn't appear that you did anything. You know, there's nothing written here. The king says, well, is anybody out in the court? And they said, well, Haman just came in. Now, here's a case of impeccable timing. Haman was coming in to ask the king's permission to hang Mordecai. This was not a good time for a request like that. The king, on the other hand, was looking for an opportunity to honor Mordecai, and he heard Haman was out there, and he said, here, send old Haman in. Haman came in, boy, you can just imagine, big grin on his face, and the king said, you know what, Haman? I want to honor somebody. What do you think we ought to do to the man that the king decides to honor? Now, Haman thought in his heart, who in the world could the king want to honor more than me? Obviously, he wants to honor me. So, Haman thinks up the biggest, most grandiose thing he can think of. You know what I think, King? You ought to put your old clothes on him and just let him ride on your horse and dress him in the royal robes. And have one of your highest servants, one of your most trusted servants, lead him through the city and just say, this is the way the king honors the man that he wants to honor. And the king says, you know, that sounds like a good idea. I'll tell you what, you go and do all of that. Mordecai the Jew is the fellow I want to honor. You just go ahead and do all that. Don't leave out anything. And you lead him through the city. And Haman told his wife and his friends, and they said, uh-oh, you're in trouble now. Well, while they were yet talking, King's chamberlain came and hurried Haman to the banquet that Esther had prepared. Well, the king and Haman came to the banquet with Esther the queen. And the king said again to Esther on the second day at the banquet, now what is your, on the banquet of wine, that was about as far as they got into the banquet. The king had a few belts, and he says, by the way, what was it we were going to do? What was the petition? It'll be granted, whatever you want, up to half the kingdom. And Esther said, well, if I found favor in your sight, and if it pleased the king, please don't let him kill me. please save my life. My life and my people. We're sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be slain, and to perish. You know, if we'd just been sold into slavery, I maybe would have held my tongue, but we're all going to be killed. Well, the king, this was, you know, it was like this is the first he had ever heard about that. And he said, who is he? Where is he that would presume in his heart to do so? Who would hurt my favorite wife? And Esther looked over and said, the adversary and the enemy is this wicked Haman. And Haman was afraid before the king and the queen. You better believe he was. King rose up from the banquet of wine in his wrath, and he went into the palace garden. He was upset, didn't know what to do. Haman, in the meantime, stood to make his request for his life, that his life be spared. And he was maybe fairly swift on the uptake. He saw there was evil determined against him by the king. The king hadn't said it yet, but he could tell by the look in his eyes. He said, you know, I'm done for. Well, the king returned out of the palace garden into the place of the banquet of wine. Haman, in the meantime, has fallen down on the bed where Esther is. And the king says, what are you going to do? Force the queen right here before my eyes? Well, as the word went out of the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. You know, some of these soldiers standing by, they didn't need any further instructions. They could read what was happening. They just went over there, dropped the cloth over his face. They were ready to take him out. And about that time, one of them spoke up and said, by the way, king, you know, there's this big gallows out there, 50 cubits high. Haman made it for Mordecai, the fellow that, you know, saved your life. He was going to hang him. And the king said, well, hang Haman on it. So they did. You know, you notice how things haven't changed. You know, the statement was made about a fella I knew a long time ago who was quite a politician. He said, you know, when things changed all of a sudden, that the joke was that he broke both legs jumping off one bandwagon to jump on the next. That's the way a lot of politicians are, and some of these, one of these Chamberlain, he was that way. You know, he had had plenty of opportunity to tell the king that Haman was going to kill Mordecai, but Haman was in power, and Haman had a lot of prestige, so he, you know, flattered Haman, and he was Haman's buddy. Now, all of a sudden, that he saw that Haman was in trouble, he just jumped in to add his little bit. Oh, by the way, you know, I got some more information for you. Going to get himself in good. So anyway, that the king's wrath was pacified. Well, the king turned Haman's house and all of Haman's property over to Esther the queen, and Mordecai came before the king because Esther explained that this Mordecai, the one that you just honored that saved your life, well, he's the one that raised me. So the king took off his ring that he had taken away from Haman and gave it to Mordecai. See, what the king wanted was somebody else to tend to the work. Here, you know, pass me another drink here. Why don't you go take care of this, all the work, all the business? And now Esther speaks to the king, and she falls down before his feet, and she beseeches him with tears. She says, you know, king, nothing has been done about this decree. And Haman signed this decree, and he devised against the Jews. And she said, look, if I found favor in your sight, please let a letter be written to reverse this decree to execute all the Jews. How can I endure to see this terrible evil come on my people? Well, the king said, look, Esther and Mordecai, I've given you Haman's stuff, and we've hung him. Now, you just write for the Jews as, you know, whatever you want. In the king's name. Seal it with the king's ring. So, you know, again, you see how much attention he played to business. I mean, on the one hand, on a whim, he signed something to kill all the Jews. Now he gives them his ring and says, well, I tell you what, I don't want to be bothered with all those details. You just write out a new law and sign my name to it, and that'll be fine. Here, you know, pass the bottle. That seems to have been his primary occupation. So they called the king's scribes in the third month, the month Sivan. This was just a little after Pentecost. And Mordecai had written this decree. They couldn't just write and say, you know, the king was drunk and he signed this stupid decree, and so we're just going to, everybody forget about it. Well, they couldn't say that. So what they said was, you know that decree about killing the Jews, that of course still stands. That's the law of the Medes and the Persians. But what we didn't mention the first go-around was the Jews have the right to defend themselves. In fact, the king hopes they will defend themselves, and so they have the right to stand together and to organize and to destroy, to slay, and to cause to perish everybody that wants to assault them. That's the rest of the decree. Well, word of that gets out. And this is going to occur on the 13th day of the 12th month. So it was published, and they sent word out. And the Jews, verse 16, had light and gladness and joy and honor. And in every province and in every city, wherever the king's commandment and his decree came, the Jews had joy and gladness and feast and a good day. And many of the people of the land became Jews, for the fear of the Jews fell upon them. You know, people, all of a sudden, they saw which way the wind was blowing. You know, let's see, the queen is a Jew, the prime minister is a Jew. Being a Jew doesn't sound so bad. So on the 12th month, the month Adar, the 13th day of the month, the enemies of the Jews had hoped to have power over them, though it was turned to the contrary. The Jews gathered themselves together in their cities to lay hand on such as sought their hurt, and no man could withstand them. The fear of them fell on all the people, and the rulers of the provinces and the lieutenants and the deputies and the officers of the king helped the Jews because the fear of Mordecai fell on them. It wasn't the fear of God that came on them. It was the fear of Mordecai. They knew which way their bread was buttered, and they knew who was in charge. And so Mordecai was great in the king's house. And the man Mordecai waxed greater and greater. So any of these people who were stupid enough to follow the first decree to come out against the Jews, well, the Jews smote their enemies with the stroke of the sword and the slaughter and destruction, and did that which they would unto those that hated them. There were 500 that were slaughtered there in Shushan the palace. And so all these people, all the news was brought, and Esther, the king said to Esther, he said, the Jews have slain 500 people in Shushan, and the 10 sons of Haman, what have they done in the provinces? Well, word got back, and the trouble still wasn't over, so the king decreed, and they added an extra day on it. And Haman's sons were now hanged, and the Jews gathered together in Shushan on the 14th day and slew another 300. And this was, so we now find that verse 17, on the 13th day of the month and on the 14th day of the month, they rested and made it a day of feast and gladness. And the Jews in the villages made the 14th day a day of gladness. And Mordecai wrote these things, sent letters to the Jews, to all the Jews in the provinces, to establish this among them, that they should keep the 14th day of the month Adar and the 15th day of the same. Now, notice the ebb and flow of things. Here things started out, and they look absolutely catastrophic. You know, first on a personal level, Esther's life is disrupted, Mordecai's life is disrupted. Seemingly, these problems happen. Why would God allow that? Then circumstances proceed along, and it looks like it goes from bad to worse, going from a personal level. Now we find the most inveterate enemy of the Jews promoted to great honor. And he starts out on a plot to destroy all the Jews. And it just looks like everything is going from bad to worse. Again, realize that Esther and Mordecai didn't know how this story was going to end any more than you and I, when we go through trials, know exactly the details of how it's going to end. What you have to do is walk by faith. Now, you go through the book of Esther and you find a number of, quote, coincidences, which really represented the hidden hand of God. God's hand wasn't dramatic. Mount Sinai didn't quake and smoke. The Red Sea didn't open up. The rivers, all the water didn't turn to blood. There wasn't some terrible plague that suddenly came on all the enemies of God. But what you find is that people simply happened to be at the right time at the right place. The king just couldn't sleep on a certain night. It just so happened when they opened the book, they just happened to open to that page. And then Haman just happened to be outside. And he was the one the king asked. And Haman, of course, just thought that they must have been talking about him, so he came up with all this other stuff. Just one thing after another after another. Going all the way back to when Esther was taken. See, it began to dawn on Mordecai when Haman's decree came out. Maybe the very reason you're in the king's palace is for this purpose. You know, Esther's life undoubtedly turned out far different than anything she would have imagined or envisioned growing up. And yet, God used her as one of the great heroines of the Bible, one of the great heroes of faith, one who was used as an instrument of deliverance for God's people. You know, it's interesting as to what you see as you look here, and you see that there was a time, you see how human nature vacillates. You know, if Haman is in charge, what you find is most people, boy, they're against Jews. Yeah, they want to kill the Jews. Yeah, they think that's a good idea. All of a sudden, Haman's not in power, and Mordecai's in power. Yeah, you know, I like Jews all along. Yeah, I'm on their side. I just, I've been thinking about being a Jew myself. You know, it's just amazing how that goes back and forth. What you find, of course, is that being popular should be taken, you know, with a huge grain of salt. Realize that so many people sort of hold their finger in the wind to see which way it's blowing, and whatever way the wind is blowing, that's the way that's what they're for. You know, you think back some of the years, I think back when Mr. Armstrong started putting the church back on the track, and boy, all of a sudden these guys, frankly, some of whom had been some of the main ones getting the church off the track, all of a sudden, boy, they thought that was great. Yeah, they were, Mr. Armstrong was putting the church back on the track. Yay, they were in favor of that. After Mr. Armstrong died, found out some of these guys couldn't even find the track, much less get back on it. And others were ready to line up and go behind them. I mean, here the Garner Ted and the STP comes along. Boy, that's popular with so many. And then Mr. Armstrong throws that out and says, you know, that's just sliding toward Protestantism. That's what STP stands for. I'm going to put the church back on the track. Yes, they're in favor of that. Boy, that's great. They thought the same thing. Then Joe DeCotch comes in and it's worse than the STP was ever dreamed of. And the next thing you know, well, yeah, they're in favor of that. Boy, that's God's man. Back and forth, back and forth. And you see this running through the book of Esther. You know, you read in the book of Acts, Paul was used of God to perform this miracle, and people were ready to sacrifice to him. The gods have come down to the earth. Next thing you know, somebody got them stirred up, and they're ready to stone him. I mean, just, you can't depend on the mob, on popularity. Now, it's sort of interesting if you, the book of Esther ends up with a celebration. You ever thought, if you go through the book of Psalms, you know, one of the things we looked at as we've gone through this series on the festival scrolls is the correlation to the five books of the law, the five books of the Psalms, and the five festival scrolls. Well, how does the fifth book of the Psalms, what is that? Well, it's a time of celebration, and it ends up with what is called the hallelujah, that the great Hallel, as the Jews call it, praise. Notice how it in fact, the last five chapters of the book of Psalms are the celebration, beginning 146, 147, 148, 149, 150. Praise the Lord, praise the Lord, praise the Lord. That's hallelujah in Hebrew. And is what you find as you, as you go through this whole section. And this emphasis on praising God. Now, what you find as you look at that is in many ways similar to the theme at the end of the book of Esther. They are celebrating, they are happy, they are thankful. God has intervened. God is going to destroy the enemies of his people, and it's a time of great rejoicing, great festivity. See, Psalm 107, which begins this fifth section, starts out, "Give thanks to the Lord, for he is good. His mercy endures forever. Let the redeemed of the Lord say so, whom he's redeemed from the hand of the enemy." That, of course, is the theme of Purim. And it ties in. You know, that is, in effect, the celebration as you find the people of God. If you just read this fifth section of the Psalms, it is certainly focused on the people of God entering into to the family of God, the resurrection, and the glorified sons of God. And it is a time of praise. Well, in the book of Esther, Mordecai writes to the Jews, and he sends this decree out, as we're told in Esther 9 and verse 21, to establish this, that they're to keep the 14th and the 15th of Adar every year. The Jews were rested from their enemies. In the month which was turned unto them from sorrow to joy, from mourning into a good day, that they should make the days of feasting and joy and sending portions one to another and gifts to the poor. And the Jews undertook to do as they had begun and as Mordecai had written unto them. Because Haman, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews, had devised against the Jews to destroy them, had cast Pur, that is, Lot, to consume them, to destroy them. When Esther came before the king, he commanded by letters that this wicked device, which he had devised against the Jews, should return unto their own head, and that he and his son should be hanged on the gallows. So they named this festival Purim, which meant lots. And so word went out in this matter. And the Jews ordained, verse 27, and took upon them and upon their seed and upon all that joined themselves to them that they should not fail, that they would keep these 2 days according to their writing and according to their appointed time every year. So it was a decree. It was not something, again, that God had commanded, but it was something they took upon themselves, a voluntary celebration of deliverance, of joy, of redemption. Interestingly, we started out on the day before Passover. News would have gotten out. You remember, the decree was signed on the 13th day of the first month. The first news would have penetrated through the palace area, through the capital city, just prior to Passover service. So here is Mordecai and the others, and they are faced with a threat of absolute destruction. Life looked bleak. It looked hopeless. Why would God allow this? Why would he allow our enemies to be in such a position of power? Well, you see, it didn't turn out that way, did it? You know, sometimes we can look at things and we wonder why. And what we have to keep in mind, the book of Esther is certainly a book that is a book of faith, because what it shows is that God already had a plan. God had a way and a means of deliverance. And God was already ahead of the curve. You see, before the decree was ever made, Esther was already in place as queen. God didn't have to scrounge around and figure out what to do. It only became apparent to human beings in the aftermath of the decree some of the reasons why God had allowed Esther to be in that role. You and I will undoubtedly go through things in the time ahead, sometimes in our lives individually, and sometimes things we may go through as a work. Things will happen and you won't understand why they're happening. And it seems like a catastrophe. You pray and you beseech God, and only in the aftermath do you see that God already had a solution before you even knew there was a problem. And that's an important lesson for all of us to keep in mind. Sometimes God operates very dramatically and openly. The book of Exodus is an example. Sometimes God operates behind the scenes You know, it's sort of interesting in the book of Esther, corresponding to the five books of the Megillah, the name of God appears five times, but it appears hidden. Sometimes God's hand is very obvious in history, and there's no mistaking it. It just, you know, announces itself long and loud, you know, like when the children of Israel gathered around Mount Sinai and the trumpet sounded long and loud and the smoke came up and the mountain quaked. There was no mistaking that God was about to say something. There was nothing secret or hidden about the hand of God. There are other times that it's subtle. It's not quite in the same way. The book of Esther shows that sometimes it's the hidden hand of God in history that makes for deliverance. So Mordecai and Esther sent out this decree, and recorded in chapter 9, verse 31. And this was confirmed, this matter of Purim. And the king laid a tribute upon the land and upon the isles of the sea, and all the acts of his power and his might, the declaration of the greatness of Mordecai, whereunto the king advanced him, they're written in the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Media and Persia. And Mordecai the Jew was next to the king, and great among the Jews, and accepted of the multitude of his brethren, seeking the wealth of his people, and speaking peace to all his seed. You know, it took quite a turn as things went by. God used that. And you know, it's interesting because it was the successor, the son and the successor of King Xerxes, Artaxerxes, who issued the decree that's recorded in Ezra chapter 7 that began the countdown for the coming of the Messiah. See, God was setting the stage to have the right person at the right time, influenced by the right individuals, that his plan and his purpose, you know, the plan and the purpose of God casts a long shadow down through history. And God works sometimes through circumstances and with scenarios that you and I would never come up with. But that's part of the lesson of the book of Esther. And you see, it ends on a note of celebration. And the note of God's whole plan ends on a note of celebration, praising God for his deliverance. I think one of the exciting, one of the fun stories of the Bible there in the book of Esther, you know, it's written in such a way that sort of plays on some of that. I think it's one that sometimes can be read just on the surface, and people don't stop and consider all of the things that are packed behind it. Next Bible study, we're going to get into the book of Daniel. What we find is we've been going through this series on the writings. Actually, the book of Daniel is considered part of the writings and comes right after the five festival scrolls, followed in the traditional canon by Ezra and Nehemiah, one book, and then Chronicles. Well, we've already gone through Ezra and Nehemiah and the book of Chronicles when we went through the historical survey of the Old Testament, so we're not going to go back through all of them. We are going to go through the book of Daniel, and then we're going to use that as the jumping-off point to get into our next series, which will be on the minor prophets. So we're going to actually cover Daniel in two stages and then go from there on into the minor prophets. So I've got study questions to pass out to you for the book of Daniel. That's what we'll do next time.